Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks for downloading this Splendid Table podcast. And if it's not your first time listening, I hope you've come back because of our mix of culture, conversation, and cooking tips and recipes. Gifts from listeners like you make all this possible. So please donate today and get a special gift from us. Contribute at splendidtable.org/donate. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. We've got a fun show for you this week. We're going to talk about Scandinavian comfort food, and from there, bounce over to the cuisine of Burma, which might be about as far away from Danish food as you can get. And we'll get a food editor's list of the best vegetarian cookbooks, and, surprisingly, they're all old enough to vote, and one of them's old enough to retire. And we'll also talk to a scientist who studies why food texture matters. But first, we want to set a few things straight in the kitchen. Every week, we check in with our friends at America's Test Kitchen to see what they're up to. But this time, we're taking a look back with them a little bit, like a survey course of useful geekery. So, you know, famously, they test their recipes a zillion times, tweaking them every which way. But in the process, they've come across a lot of supposedly ironclad rules of the kitchen that have turned out not to be so ironclad. Doc Willoughby is the editorial director for magazines at ATK, and he's collected some of his favorite myths that they've busted over the years. So, Doc, so great to have you here.
It's great to be here, Francis.
So your team kindly sent along a list of your the greatest hits of your myth-busting career at America's Test Kitchen. And so, you know, should we prepare to be shocked or mildly surprised?
I would say mildly surprised for most of them and possibly shocked by one.
So which culinary myth are you most proud of slaying?
I would say the myth that marinating actually does anything.
What?
Because this is a myth that is hard to slay. It's kind of like the myth that searing seals in juices and meat, which was discredited back in about 1989, but I think most people still believe it. So marinating is one we've just started to discredit a few years ago, so we have our work ahead of us.
Wait, tell me more, because I do not believe you. I love the marinade. I mean, I don't marinate all the time because I'm lazy.
This is the best thing when we're not believed, because, of course, we back everything up with science. Now, we started years ago feeling like actually marinating doesn't seem to be doing that much, particularly when you're doing chicken or meat, which are the things people marinate most often. So we decided to do an experiment, and so we took boneless, skinless chicken breasts in four different marinades, soy, yogurt, red wine, and lemon and garlic, and we left them in there for 18 hours. And after the 18 hours, the marinade had penetrated less than between 1 and 3 millimeters, which is less than a tenth of an inch. And that's after 18 hours. So what we did was we then took those chicken breasts, we shaved off the amount that had gone in. So we shaved off the outer 3 milliliters. Then we roasted those along with some other chicken breasts that had not been marinated, and we had people taste them. No one could taste any difference at all.
Wait,
so
what?
No one could taste any, and we... It was a blind tasting with a large panel of 30 testers. And the only way you could taste any difference at all is if you tasted one that had not had that little tiny bit shaved off. And then there was a faint difference. And this is after 18 hours of marinating. So,
yeah, that's like a long time.
It's a long time. And, you know, no one wants to marinate anything that long. So all marinating really does is put a tiny bit of flavor on the outside part of whatever it is you're marinating. And it's the other thing people say is that marinating tenderizes things. So if you use acid or you use the other thing that people often use is papaya juice, theoretically it will tenderize the meat, but what it actually does is it tenderizes to the same depth as those marinades penetrated. So all it does is make the outside of the meat or whatever you're marinating mushy. So No matter how long you marinate, you're really only going to get mushy exterior and a tiny bit of flavor on the outside. So it's actually much better to skip that whole marinating thing, cook the food, and then put the flavor on it afterwards.
Yeah, like sauce it or whatever. But what about like a brine?
Well, this is a brine actually works. And here are the exceptions to my myth busting. A brine
will
carry salt into the interior of whatever you're brining at a different rate, depending on whatever it is. And so the salt does season whatever you have in the brine, and it also makes it stay moister when you cook it. And there are two items that are water-soluble that you might have in a marinade, onion and garlic. So if you have a marinade with onion and garlic, some of that onion and garlic flavor will get some way further into the meat. But all spices, herbs, most of the things that you really want to have flavoring whatever you're marinating, they're all fat-soluble, and fat-soluble substances don't penetrate into meat or fowl. So unless you're marinating something like tofu, because if you marinate tofu, it's got a very loose structure. So that actually the marinade will penetrate into tofu. But if you're marinating meat or chicken, you're just not going to get much difference. If you put a lot of salt in your marinade or you have a lot of soy sauce, you will get a seasoned piece of meat or fish, but it won't have any additional flavor.
Ah, okay. So I'm still having trouble digesting this. I'm not sure entirely about it, but I'll buy that we have some common ground there where I can accept the brine and the salt and the soy sauce work. Okay, so let's move on to another one. What is another myth that you have busted?
Well, here's another one that is something that people have been doing forever on the sort of the faith that it works. And that is, when you roast a turkey or a chicken, if you baste it, it will end up moister and juicier because you've been basting it. So that really seemed like one of those things that, while it's kind of homey and fun to do, maybe it doesn't really work. So again,
and you get that little squeezy thing. I mean, it's great. Everyone loves doing
that. Yeah, it's kind of fun, right? But does it work? I mean, you can do it if you want to have fun, but what does it work? Let's see. So we took three chickens and three turkeys, and one set we basted every 20 minutes. The second set we just roasted without doing anything. And the third we didn't baste, but we opened the oven door and closed it every 20 minutes. And then when they were done, we measured the moisture loss in all three of them to see if any of them had stayed more moist. As it turns out, no. Moisture loss was virtually identical in all three of them. But what happened was it took 10% longer to cook the bird that we didn't baste but open and close the door, and it took about 16% longer to cook the one that we basted. Because what you're doing when you're basting is you are cooling down the surface of the bird. As it turns out, that doesn't keep it moister. It just makes it take longer to cook.
Huh.
However, and here's the however of this one. The one thing basting did do was it gave you a darker skin. So if you don't mind cooking a little longer and you know you're not going to get anything that's moister, you will get a better looking skin by basting.
Okay. I don't have any emotional attachment to basting, so you can tell me anything you want to tell me about it, and that's fine.
Okay. But you're still not believing in the marinade, right?
I'm still not buying the marinade.
So you have to do this for yourself at home, and then you'll believe it. But the next one is something that I'm very happy about because, I mean, I love my grandmother, and she was a great cook, but she always used to do these things that I didn't think really worked, and she insisted they did. So one of them was whenever she boiled corn, she put sugar in the water, and she insisted that this made the corn not only cook faster but taste sweeter. So when we were working on our boiled corn recipe, and actually we do have a recipe for boiled corn, we decided to figure out if this was correct. So we took corn and we put it in water with some blue dye, and the chemicals in this dye approximate about the same structure as salt or sugar.
Oh, cool.
So we decided to see how long it would take the blue dye to get into the corn. For it to get into the entire ear, it took, guess how long?
You don't want to boil corn for more than...
Take a guess.
Like a few minutes.
It took 2 hours.
Oh, come on.
So, and the reason for this is that kernels of corn are not permeable. They're semi-impermeable. So for the salt and sugar to get into the kernels where you could taste them, it has to go through the cob, saturate the cob, and then go into the kernels. So my grandma, despite her skill at cooking, was wrong about this.
But okay, so there's one more on this list. The myth is exactly how you whisk makes no difference. And this is not a myth. This is not a thing that people tell one another.
This is a great myth of whisking. This is what happens when you have 42 test cooks in a kitchen, and they're all doing something, and they all want to figure out who's doing it the best and most efficient way, right? So everybody's always whisking, and people have different ways of whisking. Some do it in a side-to-side. Some do it in a circular sort of stirring motion.
Yeah, that's
how I
do it.
And some beat it, which is that looping thing where the whisk comes out and goes back into the
Oh, that's how I do it, yeah.
Into the liquid. Yeah, So you're doing it the wrong way, because
<You're> killing me.
We did this. We took these three methods, and we had a bunch of different people: left-handers, right-handers, people with small hands and big hands, all the variables, to emulsify vinaigrettes, to whip small amounts of cream, and whip small amounts of egg whites. So the worst, the one that lost everyone, was circular stirring.
Okay.
It took twice as long to whip cream and egg whites as in another manner, and the dressing never got fully emulsified. The winner was side to side, just sort of back and forth, never taking the whisk out of the liquid. And the reason for that is that when you do that, it sets up what's called shear force, S-H-E-A-R force. So you're going one way in the liquid and then you're going back, but some of the liquid is still coming the direction that you were going before and runs into the other liquid. And so that's called shear force, and that makes everything mix faster.
Oh, that's interesting.
All that said, beating the way you do it, when you sort of bring it out of the mixture and back in, is best for egg whites. It was very poor for emulsifying or for whipping cream, but it was best for egg whites.
Oh, interesting.
So if you want to do egg whites, you should beat. Otherwise, use the back and forth motion.
Very cool.
So aren't you glad I busted that myth for you?
That you invented that myth to bust it? Yeah, that's great.
Well, it might have improved your kitchen efficiency anyway.
No doubt, no doubt. And plus, a chef once told me you had to do figure eights in the bowl, which I could never do.
But that might even be best. We have to add that to our next round of testing.
You got to go back. The myth of the figure eight whisking. All right. Well, thanks so much for talking, Doc. I still don't believe you about the marinating, but it's great to talk with you anyway.
You try that at home.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Francis.
Doc Willoughby is the editorial director for magazines at America's Test Kitchen. And he left us with a recipe that proves, so he says, that you don't have to marinate beforehand. It's grilled shrimp skewers, and he sends along three sauces: spicy lemon garlic, shermoula, and tomato, feta, and olive. You can find it all at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the tea eating culture of Burma, and a scientist who says flavor may really be all about texture. I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So I can't tell if a cabinet is tilted until things start rolling off of it, but my wife works in design, and so design blogs and magazines show up in our home. And if you follow these things at all, you know that the Scandinavian concept of hygge has become a thing. It's a word that usually gets translated as cozy, and the pictures you see in these magazines are, you know, a lot of shearling blankets draped just so in front of a fire, but hygge isn't just a design trend. It's a way of life. And the Danish food writer Trine Hahnemann likes to translate it more as lived in and intimate. And she relates that to food, to setting a summer table with things like parsley stuffed roast chicken with a splash of cream, or by using simple spices that sing one at a time. And with midsummer on its way, our contributor Shauna Seaver talked with Trine to learn how to get into the hygge spirit.
Trine Hahnemann, such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Now, Trine, this concept of hygge has become a bit of a buzzword, and it seems to be sort of a you know it when you see it or feel it type of thing. But can you tell us how the word is used in Denmark and how important it is to Scandinavian culture?
Yes, I mean, it's a word we use all the time, like you in America use nice, but we describe things we do as hygge or hyggeligt all the time. So it's embedded in our culture and everyday life in a very profound way. And it goes for all of Scandinavia, but the Danes are probably the ones who use the word the most. And we aim to have it hyggeligt all the time, the more the better.
And how do you do that at home?
First of all, our home is very important to us, so we try to make it hyggeligt. And you can say it's the biggest compliment anybody can give you is if they say your home is hyggeligt. And it's not about expensive furniture or paintings and all of that. It's about an atmosphere that it feels like somebody lived there. So candles, flowers, cushions, you know, all the little things that makes a house look lived in. So it's a little bit in contrast to the modern Danish design where it's very clean. That is not always hyggeligt, which is an interesting paradox.
Now, how does food fit into creating the perfect hygge experience?
The food is important because this is the way we greet each other. In Scandinavia, We don't say to each other like you do in America, how are you? I'm fine. If somebody asks you in Scandinavia how you are, you actually going to answer, and it can be long, you know. We will, first of all, offer people something to drink and eat right away, actually before we ask them anything else. Would you like coffee, wine, tea? Could I give you anything to eat? That's kind of how we start any conversation. So right there already, you've created a moment where you can have a good time together. Because I think hygge is all about creating these atmospheres and breaks and little moments all through the day. It's about finding the little pause here and there where you can create some kind of intimacy, I would say.
Now, you mentioned that hygge is for all seasons. So how does hygge fit into the spring and the summer months in Scandinavia as the days grow longer?
I mean, with season, we don't only think about produce, but also the weather and the light. So when the day starts not to be so dark, we will move more outside. But you also, you know, for dinner, you eat a lot of spring things, and you will still lit the candles. You know, we do that all year round. And you set the table probably in a bit lighter colors. And a lot of wonderful vegetables have arrived. You know, you've been eating root vegetables and cabbage for months, so you're so looking forward to the spring vegetables, which is like radishes and asparagus. And then we move into later spring, early summer, and then new potatoes come. And new potatoes is like one of the best things in Scandinavia. I think we have some of the best potatoes in the world. So that is like a celebration. And you either cook them and serve them butter or dill, or you make there's, in the book, a wonderful salad, which is a kind of traditional, but I changed it a little bit, where you put vinegar and oil on the warm potatoes so they, you know, kind of suck up all the flavors from the dressing. And then for dinner, one of my favorite things, and grandmother in Danish is mormor, so it's my mormor's chicken recipe. And it's just a chicken stuffed with parsley and roasted, really crispy skin. And then you serve it with like a sweet and sour cucumber salad and new potatoes. And my grandmother would always do it in a big black pot, you know, like a roasting pot. And then you'd have a bit of juice and a bit of fat, and she would pour that into another little pot and then just cream into it and salt and pepper. And we called it a separated sauce because it doesn't really always stick together. The fat will always be a little bit on top. And that's, for me, like the perfect Scandinavian summer dinner.
So let's say we want to bring this concept of hygge into our homes more regularly, and we really want to build a pantry that would support this. So what are your go-to staples?
Oh, salt and pepper, of course, and good pepper. I'm talking about really tasty black pepper and a very nice grinder, because you always finish Scandinavian cooking up most of the dishes with a little bit of black pepper. And you have to have a little tree with bay leaves, because there's a lot of dishes with bay leaves then. And then, of course, vinegars. You know, the more different flavored vinegars you have, the more exciting dressings you can make. Good olive oil, even though olive oil doesn't grow in Scandinavia, we've gotten used to it and we can't live without it anymore. And then, of course, butter. You've got to have butter. It's very important, especially for when you have all these summer cabbages, to fry some of them in a little bit of butter and then salt and pepper and a little bit of nutmeg on top. That's it. With new potatoes, I don't actually need much more than that on a June night. And then of course, we also use spices like cardamom and coriander and juniper berry and things like that. But we use them more one at a time. We do a lot of pickle in June, July and August, and we use the spices for that. And it's interesting, nutmeg is a very important spice in the Scandinavian kitchen, but also in a lot of sauces, just to finish it off.
Well, that all sounds delicious. I'm ready to book a ticket to Denmark right now.
Good.
Thank you so much, Trina. It was great talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Trina Hahnemann is a chef in Copenhagen and author of the book Scandinavian Comfort Food. Shauna Seaver blogs at The Next Door Baker. And Trina left us with those recipes she talked about: her grandmother's roast chicken with separated gravy, sweet and sour cucumbers, and classic potato salad. And you can find them at splendidtable.org. Imagine, if you will, the flavor of a cabbage. You got it, right? It's, you know, not the most distinctive flavor in the world, but you know it. Okay, now what if I told you that a scientist did an experiment where he fed people a cabbage-flavored jelly and only 1 in 20 people could recognize it? That's one way to gauge how important texture is in our food. If you change the texture of something, everything changes. Well, that scientist, Ole Moritzen, has a new book called Mouthfeel: How Texture Makes Taste. Our contributor Russ Parsons talked with Ole to find out more.
Ole Moritzen, welcome to Splendid Table.
Thank you very much.
Now, when we think about food and cooking, we mainly think about tastes and aromas. But as you point out in your book, there's an equally important aspect called mouthfeel. What exactly do you mean when you say mouthfeel?
Well, mouthfeel is the sort of the technical term. We also sometimes call it texture. It's a technical term that refers to the sensation of touch and feeling. And, I mean, most people, when they say taste, they really don't mean taste that is what is technically on the tongue. It's just as much in the nose or in the ears, on the eyes, and also very much in the feeling in the mouth. And usually we don't think about it unless it's contrary to what we expect. Suppose we get something which is supposed to be crisp and it's soggy, or we get a piece of meat and it turns out to be chewy and not tender, then we actually notice it. But in most cases, we don't even have a word for it. So I suppose the word mouthfeel is not even a common word. But it's very important for the entire taste experience.
Now, in the book, you point out that the Japanese have 400 words to describe the texture of food, but we in America have only 80 or so.
That's right.
And the Japanese even have three different words for mouthfeel itself. How do you think this is reflected in their cuisine?
I think it reflects, first of all, of course, that the Japanese, they are very observant as to this particular feature of the food. For instance, if you have fish in Japan, you'll see that they pay great attention to the actual texture of the fish. Most fish don't have much taste and flavor, but it's actually the texture that makes it different from one kind of preparation to the next. And there's one thing in the classical Japanese cuisine which I'm very interested in at the moment, and that's the particular way you treat vegetables. There's a technique called skemono, which basically means pickle things. And most of us who have had a Japanese meal will see that you have these little side dishes. It could be cucumber or eggplant or daikon, and they are marinated, and they have different kind of colors, different kind of flavors. And sometimes if you touch them with your fingers, you think they're not very interesting because they're sort of flexible. But once you get them in the mouth, you basically have a crunchy feeling all over your skull. And that shows that the Japanese have extreme attention to the mouthfeel. I'm also quite fascinated by seaweeds. And seaweeds is only something that is gradually coming into the Western cuisine. But in Asia and in Japan in particular, seaweeds are very common, something you eat every day. And I'm pretty sure that the Japanese do, not only because you have it as a tradition, but you also eat it because it has interesting texture. It can be chewy, it can be slimy, it can be crunchy. And the different kinds of preparations, for instance, in a miso soup or in a seaweed salad, it all reflects a deep attention to the feeling in the mouth, much less than the actual taste and aroma, because seaweeds don't have much taste of their own.
Now, you also point out in the book that in a blind test of pureed foods, most people could only identify 30 to 40% of them by taste alone. So texture is so important. Which foods were easiest and which were hardest to recognize for people? And why is the texture of that food so important?
One of the most successful experiments we do with the public is to prepare a jelly made out of various kinds of cabbages. It's only about 5% who can actually recognize it. So that usually is a big surprise because you can not recognize it from the taste alone. You're actually using the feeling in the mouth. Tomatoes is more about 50% who can recognize it. And then there are other things like various kinds of meats you can actually more easily identify. But generally, it is very difficult if you remove the original mouthfeel.
At the same time, you included an experiment for making ketchup where you used identical ingredients, but you processed them differently so that one was perfectly smooth and the other was coarse and chunky. And you found that the flavors were remarkably different.
Well, it's not the flavors that are different. It is the mouthfeel that is different. To the extent that you would say the flavor is different is possibly because the release of the aroma compounds may be different when you have to chew and when you don't have to chew. But in principle, since it is made of exactly the same things, it has the same taste and also the same aroma. But the way it feels in the mouth, it's very different. So acceptance of mouthfeel is very dependent on your expectations and your previous experiences. And expectations are also quite dependent on your culture, the way you're brought up. And that's what make, I think, the whole perception of taste so exciting, because it's not only physiology. It's just as much your upbringing, your culture, your tradition, and your expectations.
Creaminess, as you point out, seems to be a special case. It's a texture, technically, but it's one in which all of our senses combine. Can you describe what's going on?
It's something that I think it's not known in detail. One of the important aspects of creaminess is that it has to flow in a certain way in the mouth. And if you take, for instance, a mayonnaise, we think that the reason why a mayonnaise is feeling creamy is because that the oil droplets have to be a particular size such that they're basically like sort of ball bearings in your mouth. It makes it sort of feel very smooth. And if the droplets of oil is too big, it'll feel oily, even though it has the same amount of oil as a proper mayonnaise. So it's a matter of the sizes of the droplets, the way it sort of flows in the mouth, and also the way it sort of clings to the surfaces in the mouth.
You pointed out in the book that there are certain aromas that emphasize the feeling of creaminess, such as vanilla.
Yeah, that's, I think, something that most people know, that if you add a vanilla flavor, you feel it's more creamy, even though it may not be. It's something that is related to sort of the experience you have earlier, and we call it binding. I mean, a lot of the talk nowadays, certainly, about taste is sort of interpreted by processes in the brain. And there's even a new field of science called neurogastronomy that sort of tries to reflect on the neural process related to the way you perceive food. And quite often in the brain, we bind different things together. That is, that if we have an experience of vanilla and creaminess belongs together, and then if we meet vanilla in another context, then we tend to interpret it in the sense that it's creamy, even though it may be less creamy than it actually is. It's sort of a similar story, as I said before, that previous experiences and expectations sort of frames the way we experience the taste of food.
The book is wonderful. Ole Moritzen, thank you so much for being on Splendid Table.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Ole Moritzen is author of Mouthfeel, How Texture Makes Taste. Russ Parsons is author of How to Pick a Peach, and Ole left us with a recipe for caramelized potatoes, and another one with a terrific name. He calls it Vegetables Prepared So That Children Will Love Them. And you can find them at splendidtable.org. And while you're grabbing that recipe, take a look at this week's video. It's for another recipe from Lynn and Sally that you're going to want too. It's pineapple, greens, and tofu with roasted chili coconut dressing. It's, Sally admits to me, a recipe they invented only because they had to have tofu in their cookbook, but they fell in love with it. And that's all at splendidtable.org. You know, when I think of all the cuisines that I know far too little about, Burmese food sits pretty high up on that list. Part of it's political. Now called Myanmar, the country was closed off to much of the world until just a couple years ago, and there aren't many Burmese communities in the U.S. In New York City, where I live, you know, a city of 8.5 million people, there is exactly one Burmese restaurant. But I'm excited to learn more, because every time I've tasted Burmese food, I have been just blown away. It borders Thailand, China, and India, so the food is somewhat related to those cuisines too. So if you can imagine rice noodles in an almost curry-like fish broth, or firm tofu made from chickpeas that's then tossed in herbs and tamarind and fried shallots. So now there's a new Burmese cookbook from Desmond Tan, the owner of the amazingly named Bay Area restaurant Burma Superstar. Our contributor Melissa Clark talked with Desmond and his co-writer Kate Leahy about what makes Burmese food so unique.
Desmond, Kate, hi, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, definitely. It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Burmese food. You know, here in the U.S., we're not that familiar with it.
If you've had Burmese food, it'll remind you of maybe Thai food. Certain, you know, dishes might remind you of Chinese food or Indian food. And that's because it borders those countries, Thailand, China, India. But at the same time, you know, there are a lot of Burmese dishes that are uniquely Burmese and you can't get anywhere else. It's spicy, it's salty, and it's sour.
Now, Kate, before you started working on the book, did you know anything about Burmese cuisine, or did you learn it all while studying with Desmond?
I learned it all on the job. I went into the Burma Superstar Kitchen with a notebook, and my first day there, they thought I was the health department. But they quickly warmed up to me, and I was basically talking to all the different cooks and having them show me how to make the different dishes, because the first day on the job, Desmond said, you know, we don't have any recipes written down. I thought, there's no recipes? I'm starting from scratch? So I did definitely learn on the job.
So one of the things that I read from your book is that in Burma, people don't just drink tea, they eat tea, which is something that I don't think anyone else in the world does, or maybe not in many places.
It's true. It's a fermented tea, and we use that as a dressing and create a tea leaf salad. One of the dish in the restaurant, what we do is we take, you know, say any fish, take rock cod, and we wrap it with banana leaf, and we spread the tea leaf, scallions, and lemon, and we steam it for about 18 minutes. And it's a delicious, healthy fish dish.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kate, can you describe what the fermented tea leaves taste like?
Well, I think the first thing you notice, especially if you're seeing the whole leaf when it's fermented before it's been mixed with other flavors, is it has this sort of ripe smell, almost an overripe mango with a funkiness. And the funkiness is almost, to me, it reminds me of bamboo. But the leaf itself, when it's just fermented, it's also extremely bitter. So you need to soak it and season it before it becomes this sort of umami-rich snack or dressing. But it really is a unique flavor. It doesn't remind me of green tea. I mean, you're eating green tea, but it's completely its own kind of entity. And it pairs so well with things like fish sauce because it has that funk.
Now, did you take the green tea leaves and do anything interesting or have a new take on them for the book? Or was it pretty traditional?
It was pretty traditional because I think it's still such a new idea that doing too many things with it that were sort of spins on it, I thought would kind of maybe take away from the tea leaf itself and also just how popular the salad is. People love it in a salad. I know Desmond's done some cool things at the restaurant. They've mixed it with like an aioli to make a tioli. But for the book, I kept it traditional. But I will say that in Myanmar, when it's a special occasion and you're presented with a tea leaf, it's not in a salad. Oftentimes, it's in a lacquerware container where there are these beautiful tea leaves with fried bits of garlic, toasted sesame seeds, toasted peanuts, and you can pick and choose what you want to eat with those tea leaves. And those would be the highest end sort of tea leaf, or lepet, as they say in Myanmar.
In the cookbook, you have other recipes aside from tea leaves. Is there another recipe that really speaks to Burmese cuisine?
I think mohinga is definitely the one that comes to mind because everywhere you go in Yangon, you see mohinga. And Desmond, it's still one of your favorite Burmese dishes.
Absolutely. It's also my daughter's. And it is a slow-cook stew soup-like type of a dish. We use catfish and cook it for about 2-3 hours until all the fish are broken apart, and use that as a base.
It's almost, I think of it as the Burmese answer to pho or any kind of brothy soup that you would have in Southeast Asia. But it's very specific to Myanmar because it has this depth of flavor from the catfish. It has rice noodles. It's also thickened sometimes with ground rice and other times with chickpea flour. And I find that's another really cool thing about Burmese food is they use a lot of different ways to thicken soups. And oftentimes they seem so, I don't know, modern to me, using chickpea flour to thicken a broth. But, I mean, they've been doing this for centuries.
Well, thank you guys so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Melissa, for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Desmond Tan and Kate Leahy are authors of the cookbook Burma Superstar, Addictive Recipes from the Crossroads of Southeast Asia. Melissa Clark's latest book is Dinner, Changing the Game. And Desmond and Kate left us with a recipe for that famous tea leaf salad on splendidtable.org. We'll be back soon with your calls. I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam. All right, so now I get to talk with you. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, or we're always on email, contact@splendidtable.org. We have Lori calling. Hey, Lori, where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
Ah.
I am calling today in regards to roasted vegetables. Due to my crazy work hours, I have to buy frozen primarily instead of fresh vegetables. Uh-huh. But I love the char and crunch of roasted fresh vegetables.
Yeah.
So is it possible to roast frozen vegetables without them steaming and turning to mush? And if so, when can I add spices and oils?
Oh. You know, this is a really interesting question. I would try maybe a couple things. One thing you could try is maybe take them out of the freezer the night before or something and put them in a bowl in the fridge so they defrost. And
okay.
I would try, after they defrost, dump them out onto paper towels and blot them dry. If they're coated with water, basically, is what will keep them from really roasting nice and brown. So if you try to blot them dry like you would a piece of meat before you sear it or something, you can try that. And if they're not super, super wet, season them with salt or oil or, whatever you want to use. Make sure your oven is real hot and, spread them out on one layer in a sheet pan so they're not all clumped up and sitting on top of each other. Give them a little room between each vegetable and give that a try. And the worst thing that happens is, you'll have like nicely cooked vegetables and just not quite super brown.
Okay.
Or what you could do, this is a little bit fussier, so I don't know if this will really work for you, but you could try to get a pan super hot with a little bit of oil. And same thing, like lay the vegetables in the pan in one layer and just let them sear on one side. So you'll get
some
of that browning action. And maybe they don't roast all the way around, but you'll get that nice caramelized flavor at least on one side eventually. And then you can sort of flip them and toss them until they're cooked through.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for these tips. I'm so excited.
Sure. I mean, I don't know if they'll work, so they'll thank me quite yet. But let me actually ask you this, because this is important. What kind of vegetables are you using? Because that might make a difference.
Typically the usual ones, like Brussels sprouts, carrots, broccoli, usually the medley that comes in the frozen bags.
Okay. Because I'm thinking if they're small in size, it might be harder. Only because if they're small, they might cook too quickly before you have enough time for the heat to really get them brown. And the other thing I'd say is something I do that seems to work for me in terms of my schedule. The same thing for me oftentimes, like I come home from work and I don't have that much time to get dinner ready. And what I try to do is I try to like spend a little time on Sunday or over the weekend and do just some of the simple pre-prep. So I can buy a head of broccoli. I can cut that up into the florets that I like and just kind of keep that in a bowl or in a Tupperware or like a little plastic bag in the fridge. And so it's ready for me. And so right when I get home, I can turn on the oven. I can season it up, get that oil, get it in the oven within, just a few minutes. So it doesn't save you time in terms of like you still got to do the stuff, but you can do the stuff when it's more convenient for you.
Wonderful. Oh my gosh. Thank you so, so much for your advice today. I am so excited to experiment with this.
Yeah. Give it a try and see how it goes. And give us a call back and let us know if it works for you.
Will do. Oh my gosh. Thank you so, so much for your time today. I'll talk to you later.
You too. Take care. All right. We have Kevin calling from Omaha. Hey, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
All right, Kevin. So what can I do for you today?
So I have a cinnamon roll recipe that I absolutely love. It's a gooey cinnamon roll recipe. It makes very large rolls, and there's the problem. So the solution that I had thought of was to essentially make the same amount of dough and to cut it in half before rolling out, essentially doubling the number of rolls that I would get out of it. The question that I have is, if I do that, what should I account for in terms of, impact on bake time, filling, any other consideration, length of cooking, anything that I need to consider if I try that kind of adjustment.
Huh. Okay, well, so you're sure that having too much cinnamon roll is a problem?
Yeah, trust me. This thing makes rolls about the size of my head, so okay. I want to have something. Want to have something smaller?
Okay. So, when you're baking them, do you bake them in a pan, and do they sort of press up against one another when you put them in the pan, or is it the kind of separate?
Yeah, when I place them in the pan, they're actually not touching each other. And then by the time they're done with baking, they've swelled, you know, they've probably doubled in size and filled up the pan.
Okay. So, well, first of all, don't change the oven temperature, because often the oven temperature is calibrated to the rising time.
Okay.
So if you hit it too hard with heat, then it might like puff a lot, but then like you might kill all the yeast before it's finished raising, you know, so on and so forth. It just changes the way it rises. So I wouldn't screw too much with the temp. But if you're putting them in the same pan, I would think you could experiment with just doing the recipe as it normally works. Because if it's going to fill the same sort of area, then maybe it's not a problem. I would, as a matter of practice, I would check a little bit earlier, maybe shave off a quarter or a third of the baking time, maybe half if you want to be really careful about it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just take a look. There's no hard and fast rule, unfortunately, for when you change the scale of something in the bake time. I've asked around a lot for this kind of thing, and no baker's ever said to me, oh, you can always do, you know, this fraction or this percentage or whatever. But what they always do tell me is, you know what? You just kind of get a feel for it and just see where you are. And when you get the same coloration that you normally like, that same kind of level of browning, it looks done, it smells good like it normally does. Yeah, then maybe it takes 3/4 of the time, maybe it takes 2/3 of the time. You mark it down, you're good to go next time.
Excellent. I'll try that.
Cool. Enjoy those rolls.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And remember, you can always call us, leave us a message, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Facebook or Twitter or email contact@splendidtable.org. We check our email constantly because we have no work-life balance. So something like 30 years ago, my mom turned to us and told us she was going to be a vegetarian. And that's not so weird now, but back then, I remember feeling almost scared. Like, what's wrong? What's happening? And what's mom going to eat? And then came the food, right? She didn't know how to cook good vegetarian food back then and, you know, didn't know anyone else who could. And so for a few years, she ate a lot of canned soy ham. Well, obviously, vegetarianism in America has evolved since then. But to this day, mom is amazed when she goes to like a fancy chef restaurant and there's more to eat for her than like a plate of steamed vegetables. She was so scarred by vegetarian food in the 80s. But it turns out that she probably just didn't know where to look. Our friend Joe Yonan, food editor at the Washington Post, more recently became a vegetarian. And he swears that he gets the most inspiration for creative cooking from a handful of cookbooks from 20, 40, and 50 years ago. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked with him to find out why these books are classics.
Hey, Joe Yonan, nice to have you back.
Thanks, Sally. Great to be here.
You are a recent vegetarian, and I think a lot of people are recent vegetarians, but you are in this unusual situation in that you see probably every book published in your job at the Washington Post.
Right.
So I am wondering, what are the vegetarian books that you really use at home?
Well, you know, I've been vegetarian for, it'll be 5 years pretty soon.
That happened fast.
5 years goes by fast. And yeah, it's true. There are so many great books coming out all the time and a lot of really great vegetarian books. But a lot of the ones that I turn to time and time again are much older. Not exclusively, but there are some fascinating books that are really feel modern in a way still that are decades, decades old. So I'm thinking particularly about one called Ten Talents.
I've never even heard of Ten Talents.
What? Yes, it's a book that was written by Rosalie Hurd and her husband and they're Seventh-day Adventists. And they named the book after a quote from the founder of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which is really wonderful. I have to read it to you. She wrote, this is Ellen White. She wrote, "The one who understands the art of properly preparing food and who uses this knowledge is worthy of higher commendation than those engaged in any other line of work. This talent should be regarded as equal in value to 10 talents." Isn't that wonderful?
That is pretty wonderful.
And the book, I learned about it from my sister. My sister in Maine is a vegetarian going way back. And I had seen the book on her bookshelf. It's a relatively recent adaptation, updated edition of the book that has photos. And I have to warn people, if they get the latest edition of the book, the photos are regrettable. I was making fun of the book as I do with some of the things from my sister's old hippie lifestyle. And then she made me some things that I thought were wonderful. And I asked her, where did she get this recipe? There was this beautiful little walnut oat burger that she made that was fantastic. And she said, oh, 10 talents. And that happened 3 or 4 times. And I thought, you know, I got to look a little more closely at this book. And it's a very interesting book.
You brought the book in. It's a spiral bound. It almost looks like a community church book.
Yes.
But it is hefty.
It's very thick now once they added all those regrettable photos.
What else is on your list that you go back to?
You know, probably the next big important one was the Moosewood Cookbook from Molly Katzen. This was originally in the 70s, 1977. She initially wrote this as a spiral bound book, too. It was just basically her drawings, her hand-lettered recipes and drawings when she was one of the cooks at the cooperative, the Moosewood Collective restaurant in Ithaca, New York. And she got so many requests for them, and she was mailing them all around that 10 Speed Press finally approached her about publishing it. And it became one of the best-selling cookbooks of all time.
And it's still in print.
Millions of copies still in print. She updated it, a 40th anniversary edition. She went through and lightened some of the recipes. She cleaned up the hand lettering, which I think is very funny, but it's not printed in typography still. It's still hand lettered. But these are the dishes that they served in the restaurant when she was there. So, and I still make some things out of it. She was doing pizza with a zucchini crust, you know, decades before you heard of these cauliflower crust pizzas that people are doing today. And she's got lots of really great info in there. I still think about one thing that she says about salads. She says, be a benefactor with the oil, a miser with the vinegar, a poet with the salt, and a demon with the pepper.
Oh, the 1970s.
I just love that.
Great advice.
Isn't that great? Isn't that great?
It's great advice. And is there a vegetarian book that you kind of think of as your joy of cooking or your really large companion? And what is that?
Absolutely. That is Deborah Madison's Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone, which
is a great book.
It's just an incredible book. The original edition had, I think, 1,200 recipes. She added a couple hundred recipes when she updated it in 2014. If you are vegetarian or you want to eat more vegetarian meals and you were to get only one book, this is the book that you should get. Absolutely. It's brilliant.
It is a pretty amazing book. It's interesting because two of the people that you just talked about are not vegetarians. Molly Katzen is not a vegetarian, nor is Deborah Madison.
That's right. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. I mean, they eat mostly vegetarian, I think, but they're not purists about it. And I think that the fact that they aren't vegetarian this will probably get me in trouble, but it might possibly be one of the reasons why they are able to create food that's really appealing for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Joe, this is such a great list. Thanks.
My pleasure, Sally.
Joe Yonan is author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. You can find Joe's recipe for cheesy beans and rice, a peasant's bowl, at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. I hope you had fun with us. Thank you so much for listening. And I'll be back next week. But in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And hey, I want to get one more plug in for our website, splendidtable.org, where you can find tons of recipes, register for our monthly giveaway, take a look at our video collection, and sign up for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, where you get recipes streamlined for weeknight eating. And if you want to take the show with you wherever you go, subscribe to our podcast, and if you like it, please leave us a review. It really helps us out. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell, with help from Courtney McEwen. Jennifer Lukey is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.